So I ran up behind them and kind of at the last possible moment watched him fall about 20 feet, hit this ledge, and then bounce off into blackness.
Welcome to the show. I'm Jordan Harbinger. As always, I'm here with producer Jason DeFilippo. Tommy Caldwell is a superstar in the rock climbing community. Since age 3, Tommy's been traveling the world, challenging himself on impossible rock faces and climbs that many other people wouldn't even attempt. Most recently, he climbed the Dawn Wall of El Capitan at Yosemite National Park. This is literally an almost entirely flat rock surface. Watching these guys do this on Netflix, they've got the Dawn Wall. This is like watching Spider-Man scale a skyscraper, except Spider-Man has more handholds than those guys did. It's just unbelievable. Before El Cap, Tommy lived an extreme childhood, and early in his career, he was even kidnapped by militants in Kyrgyzstan, sliced off his finger as if free climbing wasn't hard enough already. Today's episode has some great stories and a really in-depth look at someone who is obsessed with a craft and has pursued it to mastery. I really enjoyed this conversation, and I know you will as well. If you want to know how I managed to get all these amazing folks on the show and maintain relationships with hundreds of people for professional and personal reasons, check out 6-Minute Networking, which is free, jordanharbinger.com/course. The more people that know this stuff, I think the better off we all are. By the way, most of the guests on the show, they actually subscribe to the course and the newsletter. So come join us, and you'll be in great company. In the meantime, here's Tommy Caldwell. I know you started climbing at age 3, and your dad was into it. And I'm wondering, your dad was an adventurous guy, he's a big bodybuilder, school teacher guy, as per the movie. But you being born early, a little bit premature, do you think he did some of what he did to maybe toughen you up a little bit?
Yeah, certainly. I mean, I think the fact that he had this scrawny little kid, probably for a macho bodybuilder, pained him greatly, and so he had to figure out a way to combat that. Now, I only say that, I guess, like half tongue in cheek. He was a school teacher as well as a bodybuilder, and so he thought a lot about how to take the kind of smaller self-conscious kids and make them more confident, and rock climbing was his avenue for that, and I was his perfect test subject.
Yeah.
Yeah, I had no confidence. I was really, really naturally shy, really like mentally delayed when I was young, and climbing is what fixed it for me in a lot of ways.
We had a good laugh watching the movie the other day because my mom was a special ed teacher. And he said something like, well, I was mentally delayed probably up until now.
Still, yes.
Still.
That never leaves you.
Yeah, I'm wondering, though, like, okay, you're maybe not the best student at that age. Or at 3, you're definitely not a student at all. But in early days, you're maybe not the best student. So having an outlet like climbing probably is one of the few things at that age that maybe you're really kicking butt.
Yeah, I mean, it worked for me because I started so young that I became good at it without having any metric to measure how good I was. So then when I had friends that got into it later, I was already the badass. And the fact that my dad was taking me into the mountains and exposing me to physically really hard things from a really young age meant that by the time I kind of got a bit older, I was actually really tough. I was small and I wasn't all that intellectual, but I could endure.
Do you think that being small of stature is an advantage in climbing? Because I am never going to climb a mountain, hopefully. I don't think. Maybe I'll walk up one. But being small in stature seems like an advantage because you're pulling weight up with one or two arms, if you're lucky, maybe some feet, maybe some legs. Like having a small, slight build seems like a good advantage.
Yeah, for certain types of climbing, and specifically climbing that has really small holds, it's good to be small. Like if you think about it, like a spider's a way better climber than an elephant, you know? So
generally, yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, so the smaller, the better in a lot of ways, except you can't carry as much stuff.
Oh, yeah.
When you're really small.
So, you can have a climbing partner that can carry all your stuff.
Right. So I feel like that's where it's going to go in the future. The really small people are going to have the whole team that supports them and does everything else.
Now that you're, I mean, you got a high public profile now, you can have like a climbing intern, right? Who just follows you around with your stuff.
I probably could have.
Yeah. That you should leverage that. Look into
that. Yeah, totally.
Yeah. The childhood looked pretty extreme. You were camping solo, which is kind of scary even now, but you're doing that what how old were you when you're out in the woods by yourself?
I mean, I went a few miles from my house in Rocky Mountain National Park and camped solo starting at age 9 or something. So yeah, I was pretty young.
I'm trying to think, I just had a kid 6 weeks ago. I'm trying to think like, okay, at what age will I let him walk into a park by himself with a tent and stay overnight?
Yeah, it's funny. My dad always, I mean, still to this day, he talks about, he's kind of a curmudgeon. He thinks society is, you know, these helicopter parents. And he's like the antithesis of that. He really wants you to have this self-reliance and independence. And so that's how I was raised. He encouraged that kind of activity, which gave me a huge sense of responsibility. I mean, climbing is all about risk management. I learned that really young.
Was your mom not like, hey, maybe don't send him out into the middle of the woods alone to make a fire? Like, he can't even microwave macaroni and cheese. Maybe we should leave him in the garage.
Yeah, there's definitely moments of that. I mean, the one example that blows my mind the most is my dad likes to talk about the story of taking me when I was 3 winter camping. So we skied like a few miles into the mountains and dug a snow cave. Apparently I was still in diapers during this raging storm. And my mom does say that on that occasion during this raging storm, that whole night she was just up, you know, pacing around, like worried about it. But for the most part, she just has full trust. I mean, what do you do if you have a husband and a child who are really into doing risky things? You learn to trust them.
I don't know, Jen. What do you do when you have a husband that's into doing risky things? My kid's too young to be into risky things, but it's only a matter of time. Yeah.
Yep.
I know that your dad taught you a lot of lessons, like it's not what happens in your life, but how you react to it. For example, when you did 827 miles for your 100-mile challenge in school, and they literally didn't even believe you. That's heartbreaking, right? And you learned from an early age, not only can you do things other people can't, but that also maybe nobody will ever even believe that you're doing them.
Yeah. I mean, the fact that I was really shy was an advantage in that way. I learned about personal satisfaction because I really didn't want to deal with other people. I just didn't like being around other people.
Yeah. Has that changed? I mean, you seem really social right now. Or are you just like, I can fake it?
It has changed largely because of my wife. I'm married to one of the most social people in the world these days. And so, yeah, people are lovely. And it took me, you know, 30 years to figure that out.
Yeah, that's all right. Late bloomer. No problem. I'm with you on that. Yeah. It does seem like your dad built grit through like a combination of what most people would consider traumatizing experience and maybe a little encouragement along the way.
That's a common question I get. Like, how do you get better at these kind of scary things? You just expose yourself to minorly traumatizing experiences on a slightly increased level day after day. And at some point, you get better at doing things that most people would consider majorly traumatizing, but to you they only seem minorly.
Is there a line where like you're like, okay, I'm never doing something like this? Because it seems, and we'll get into some of the things that you've done, especially with climbing, but are there things with climbing or maybe outside of climbing where you're like, no, I'm never going to do that, that's too ridiculous?
Well, both. Yeah, I feel like I risk myself enough climbing that I kind of don't do things that are risky outside of climbing. Right. Like, I'm not going to buy a motorcycle. That's kind of the main one that I talk about. But also, a bunch of climbers about 10 years ago in Yosemite got into wingsuit base jumping.
Oh, yeah.
And I was spending all my time in Yosemite, and it's illegal there, but it's also kind of one of the best places to do it in the world. It's one of the safest places to do it in the world, actually. And so it was very tempting to get into it at that time because you see all your friends flying around like birds, and it just looks amazing. And plus, it's a pretty nice way to get down from the mountain afterwards. You don't wreck your knees as much. But I will say that the community of real core Yosemite climbers, there's maybe like 20 of them, and maybe 10 of them really got into serious wingsuit base jumping, and only 3 are still alive.
Oh, that's really bad.
Yeah.
That's horrible.
Yeah.
70%.
Yeah.
I'm not trying to make light of it, but when 70% of the people into something are expiring doing that thing, there's like a heroin user control group that is probably doing better than that.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah. And then out of the 3 that are still alive, you know, 1 is missing a leg. Ugh. And yeah, I mean, it's bad.
That's like adrenaline addiction to the point of a sickness instead of actually like, wow, look at what we're pushing the limits of. It's crazy.
Yeah. And I think of a lot of risky climbing. I wonder, you know, it's admired in a lot of ways, especially big Himalayan alpine climbing. Like in my culture, that's really admired. People that can go up and do these really hard mountains where, you know, you're up on the side of the mountain for like a week and you only have, you know, a small soup packet each day. And, you know, like being able to endure that is really admired. But I've started to look at it in ways as almost like a drug addiction. Like, why is that so admired? Why? You know, most of these people, it is really, really dangerous. I think big Himalayan alpine climbs are kind of like wingsuit base jumping. There's just so many unknown variables. And so that is another thing that I basically, at this point in my life, say that I won't do.
My buddy David Roski, who's been on the show, I don't know if you know him at all. David Roski, he summits things like K2 and Everest, but no oxygen.
Right.
And that's kind of crazy to me as well.
Yeah. So I'm talking about like big, steep alpine faces. Okay. Like the typical climbing up the fixed ropes on Mount Everest or something. I see that as very much less dangerous.
Yeah. He seems more measured. He's like not in a hurry to do things that might get him killed. He just wants it to be just hard enough where he's growing as a person.
Yeah.
Which makes sense, right?
Yeah, that's like, a good way to be.
Yeah. You don't need to base jump from with the Red Bull dude who's like jumping from space basically. You know this
Yeah.
It's like you don't need to do that. No, I'm good. Yeah. I'm just gonna go ahead and skydive. I'm fine.
But I mean one really cool thing about climbing though is you do take things that seem really dangerous or deadly, and you figure out ways to make them safe. And oftentimes there is ways to make them safe, and that's kind of an empowering thing. Like if you can do things that seem improbable or impossible and make them doable, that's like in climbing, that kind of opens up the world in so many ways. And you start to wonder how that applies other places in life.
Yeah, I can imagine that solving a problem, which is essentially what a really complex climb seems to be, like the Dawn Wall, where you're figuring it out like a puzzle, that confidence must translate to other areas of your life.
Yeah, I mean, so I was really shy and didn't like to be social. Mm-hmm. I got good at climbing because I was so deeply into it, and it did bring a lot of confidence into my life. And because of that, I've been able to sort of like take the opportunities that climbs like the Dawn Wall presented and run with them, like write a book and be on this podcast right now. Mm-hmm. Like this is never the kind of thing that I would have wanted to do or had the confidence to do if climbing had never been there to sort of like help me get there.
As a teenager, you started climbing in competition on these artificial walls. I think we've all seen those, right? Like at a climbing gym or on a cruise ship now, they're popular. These little like colored fake stones are screwed into the wall.
Yeah.
And you won this adult competition at age 13. Was that one of the first times you realized like, oh, I'm better at this than I thought? Did you have any measuring stick before then?
There wasn't really a measuring stick because kids didn't climb back then. Yeah. It wasn't a family activity. Most people considered it a sport for either kind of like adrenaline junkies, or it was just so countercultural back in that day. So the fact that my parents did it with me was real odd. But it also meant that I gained skill at an age that nobody else did. And then it turns out that small 18-year-old build actually lends itself really well to climbing. So all those things came together at this competition that I entered, not thinking that I even had a chance, and then ended up winning it. And that was like the awakening. That was the moment where I was like, wow, I'm a climber now. This is what I want to do with my life.
There's probably no way back then, though, to make a living as a professional climber, right?
I mean, making a living as a climber is kind of a funny thing because living the life of a homeless person in the culture of climbing that I was in was actually very admired. That meant that you were willing to forego any creature comforts in life to dedicate yourself 100% to climbing. And so you lived in caves and you ate the food off of the people had left on the tables at the Yosemite cafeteria.
Ooh.
And that's
that's
kind of what you did. And so I spent a few years of my life out of high school like dumpster diving and living on like $50 a month. And the thing about that is it was actually a pretty lovely time. I enjoyed it thoroughly. Life was simple. All I had to do was think about climbing. In the years since then, I have made what is more typically thought of as a proper living off climbing. But I don't think of the money part too much. Like I'm always like, man, life is nice when you don't have that much money. Because, you know, as long as you have enough to give you the basic amenities and be able to buy the things that are, you know, actually like mandatory for being healthy, you can live cheaply and it's pretty nice.
Yeah. I would imagine though, there is a line where you're like, I don't want to eat hot dog bites off of a plate that has flies on it, or like a squirrel got to it before I did and chasing him.
These days for sure. Like I think anybody whose lifestyle improves, it's hard to go backwards, especially with a family.
Yeah. The wife might not be too thrilled if you've got little fits eating off of the cafe. Go get it. It's run.
Yeah, that's right.
Before they throw it away. Yeah.
Although that probably would be a pretty successful technique.
I think so. That's something your dad would come up with, right? Like if you can eat if you can chase down the person before they get to the garbage
can. Right.
Yeah. Types of climbing. Okay, the sport climbing, is that the one with the wall with the fake rock screwed into it? There's different types of climbing that we're not really familiar with.
Yeah, so sport climbing is essentially a wall that's usually between like 50 and 150 feet in length. You have pre-placed anchors. So somebody's actually drilled a hole in the rock and installed bolts that you clip into. Mm-hmm. So essentially what that does is it makes it so that you get all of the physical difficulty of climbing with none of the danger.
Gotcha. So that might be an actual rock. The climbing wall type, it doesn't matter if it's wood or stone.
Right. So sport climbing could be outside or it can be on an artificial wall.
Gotcha. Okay. And then there's the way that you climb, you use regular rocks that are naturally occurring in nature, but there's no assist from the ropes, right? You're not pulling up on anything.
Right. So I'm a free climber, which free climbing is actually a terrible term. Because everybody, when they hear that word free, they think no ropes.
That's what I thought.
Fall, you die. But yeah, what it means is that you are climbing the surface in front of you and you have the ropes that are only there in case you fall. Free soloing is when you climb in without any ropes and if you fall, you die.
That's like walking around in a mountain and hoping you don't get struck by lightning, but carrying a giant metal flagpole with you the whole time. I feel like, or like,
I mean, way more dangerous than that.
Statistically, much more dangerous, right? Yeah.
Yeah. Free soloing is like you have to do everything perfectly, or if you die.
Yeah. I don't need that kind of adrenaline. That's surfing covered in animal parts and blood.
Well, adrenaline is another misconceived thing. Like, if adrenaline is happening when you're climbing, something is going wrong. So even free soloists don't do it for the adrenaline. They do it for the mastery. They're trying to actually control their body in a way that they can do extremely risky things without having any adrenaline involved.
That's a good point, because if you're starting to shake and vibrate and hyperventilate and panic, it's probably a great way. You wouldn't have a career very long as somebody who climbs without ropes.
Right, you would. If you have that reaction, you're not going to be a free soloist.
Yeah, that definitely makes sense. I think gently falling, or maybe not gently, but falling and not dying, that's probably the best way to learn how to climb better each time.
Yeah, which is why sport climbing is really nice, because like there's days when I go sport climbing where I fall 100 times in one day and the rope just catches you and everything's good.
Yeah, thank God for that. This dirtbag culture of climbing seems like something that would get old pretty fast. And I assume moving to Colorado and trying to get better at this, you start building a lifestyle and you start working on different skills. And I know that you've done things like going to France and spending time in places where 100+ people are dying just to work on like certain types of skills. You wrote about that. And I'm wondering, what is that? You're like climbing these caves and working on these skills that really you can only work on in these grottos, I guess. I'm trying to put a visual to this.
Oh, so you're talking about like going to France, going to Chamonix.
Yeah, that sounds right.
Okay, so Chamonix is sort of, you know, Europe's, you know, center stage for big alpine style climbing. Mm-hmm. And yeah, those mountains, like 100 people a year die. But those are the people that are pursuing a very risky form of, those are like the wingsuit-based jumpers of climber, you know. Or they're just the tourists that don't know any better. Because the thing about Chamonix is you can take a lift from the valley floor at 3,000 feet. You know, you can be sitting in the cafe drinking cappuccino, and 20 minutes later, you can be at 14,000 feet in the middle of the most gnarly alpine terrain in the Alps, and you can just basically step off the platform and fall to your death in a crevasse. So that's why so many people die. It makes the mountains too accessible. You don't have to get up there.
Yeah, that's, you got to earn your way up there. That way you know you're not supposed to be there after a few steps, right?
Right. So the mountains in the U.S. don't have lift access like that. So you do have to earn your way, and so a lot less people die. That's very different than the style of climbing that I primarily went to France for. Like, I climbed those big mountains, but we were experienced in big mountain terrain, so we weren't doing anything that was particularly risky when I was 14 years old with my dad. But really, we went to France because we wanted to go sport climbing, because that was the cutting edge of, like, physical innovation. Like, people were taking gymnastic skills and applying them to steep rock faces, and that was kind of a new thing, and it was exciting to us, and that's where it was all going down.
A lot of people think climbing is mostly about strength or endurance, but that doesn't seem to be the case. Like, watching the Dawn Wall, there's a lot of, maybe not chess, maybe that's kind of a bad analogy, but there's all kinds of fear management and risk management, and you're managing your endurance. You're trying to think like, okay, there's this thing I either had to jump across, and you tried that for a couple days, didn't work, and then you found a route underneath it. It's like a whole battle plan. There's so much more strategy involved, I think, than most people think of.
Yeah, I think that's one of the things that really has attracted me to the specific style that I love of big wall free climbing, because there's so many elements. You have to figure out how to live on the vertical wall and perform at a really high level. And logistically, that's pretty complicated to like fuel yourself and, you know, stay out of the sun and deal with storms. And then the actual climbing takes rehearsal much the way, you know, like a gymnastics routine would. And at a very high level, it'd be like an Olympic level gymnastics routine. You have to execute it perfectly and able to be successful.
Yeah.
So you do that on pitch after pitch after pitch of climbing. And it's just a tremendous puzzle that I really love gathering those pieces and figuring out how to put them together.
You're listening to the Jordan Harbinger Show with our guest, Tommy Caldwell. We'll be right back.
This episode is sponsored in part by ZipRecruiter. Hiring can be a slow process. I should know, I have tried to do that many times. Sometimes I've succeeded, many times I have failed. Cafe Altura's COO, Dylan Miskowitz, needed to hire a director of coffee for his organic coffee company. See, normally director of coffee sounds like somebody who gets coffee, but I guess if you have an organic coffee company, it's something else. Anyways, having trouble finding qualified applicants, so he switched to ZipRecruiter. ZipRecruiter doesn't depend on candidates finding you. It finds them for you. That's a huge difference. And trust me, that is very handy to say the least. So Dylan posted his job on ZipRecruiter, said he was impressed by how quickly he had great candidates apply because the technology identifies people with the right experience and then invites them to apply to your job. So you get qualified candidates fast, not just a huge stack of resumes that you then get to sift through. And then ZipRecruiter's candidate rating feature lets you filter applicants so you can focus on the ones with the most relevant experience. And that is how Dylan found his new director of coffee in just a few days. 4 out of 5 employers who post on ZipRecruiter get a quality candidate within the first day. Jason?
See why ZipRecruiter is effective for businesses of all sizes. Try ZipRecruiter for free at our web address, ZipRecruiter.com/Jordan. That's ZipRecruiter.com/JORDAN. ZipRecruiter.com/Jordan. ZipRecruiter, the smartest way to hire.
This episode is also sponsored by Figs. Now, when I got this company as a sponsor, I thought, but scrubs for medical professionals, you know, those bedsheet-looking things that people wear that make them look like they made it at home? Well, Figs is, this is the awesome version of that. Doctors, nurses, dentists, people who work in medicine, healthcare, you're awesome people. We love you. We would probably have no teeth and or die really young without you. And every one of you has helped us at some point in our life, right? So these amazing people, they dedicate their lives to caring and serving others, and then we dress them up in freaking used pillowcases that don't fit. And so Figs is an amazing company. They make scrubs that are stylish and functional. For years, these things are ugly and uncomfortable. Figs creates high-quality medical apparel so that medical professionals look their best. They've got stretch pockets. I had a bunch of these, and I thought, okay, I'm going to give them away to the medical professionals that I know and then call them back in a couple of weeks for, I guess, a report. The antimicrobial fabric protects from germs and bacteria, which, of course, are everywhere in that environment. They're really soft. They moisture wick. They've got this 4-way stretch so that you can wear them when you're bending over, doing whatever you're doing or working on a patient or just carrying a bunch of stuff. They're not going to get all stretchy, pulley, heavy, saggy, and gross. And they've got yoga waistbands. They've got a bunch of different styles. So I recommend trying these out if you are in the medical industry or if you live, love, work with somebody in the medical industry. They're big on gifting it, and I've got a pair here that I wore as pajamas and eventually gifted because they are so good that I felt like they went to waste with just me sleeping in them. That's how good they are. So Jason, tell them where they can get their Figs.
So whether you're one of the awesome humans that works in healthcare or someone that wants to say thanks to these deserving folks, Figs is going to make that easy by providing you with 15% off your first purchase by using our code JHS. Get ready to love your scrubs. Head to WearFigs, that's WearFigs.com, and enter our code JHS at checkout.
Also, Figs gives back, and you can too. Every time you shop at Figs, they give scrubs to healthcare providers in need around the world through their Threads for Threads initiative. So to date, Figs has donated hundreds of thousands of sets in over 35 countries. That's a lot of scrubs.
Thanks for listening and supporting the show. And to learn more and get links to all the great discounts you just heard from our amazing sponsors, visit jordanharbinger.com/deals. And don't forget, we have a worksheet for today's episode so you can make sure you solidify your understanding of the key takeaways from Tommy Caldwell. That link is in the show notes at jordanharbinger.com/podcast. If you'd like some tips on how to subscribe to the show, just go to jordanharbinger.com/subscribe. Subscribing to the show is absolutely free. It just means that you get all the latest episodes downloaded automatically to your podcast player, so you don't miss a single thing from the show. And now back to our episode with Tommy Caldwell.
What's like your least favorite part of it? I know that's a dumb, potentially dumb question because you probably love everything, but there's got to be something where you go, you know, I hate pooping in a bag. Like, that's the worst. I really wish there was a way around this.
I mean, when friends die.
Oh, okay. That got dark. That's... Yeah. Jeez. All right. Well, that makes sense.
which is common, honestly. I mean, really? I've probably had 40 plus close acquaintances and or friends that have died in the years that I've been climbing. So that's a big part of it. We're trying not to go that dark.
No, that's fine. I was just kind of kidding. Of course, that's the worst part. I mean, that should have been a really obvious answer to that question. Sure.
Right.
But if you weren't going with, yes, the death of people you know and love, what's the second place?
You know what's really annoying about climbing is I think a lot of adventure sports, you can take a season off, like snowboarding, for instance, and you still have all those skills and you come back and you can still operate at a mm-hmm. relatively high level. In climbing, if you want to climb well, you have to just like constantly be at it, training 3, 4, 5 days a week. And if you take a week off, you lose so much.
What are you losing? Strength or like?
Yeah, you're losing strength and coordination and just like the feel of it. You have to just be relentlessly dedicated to do it, which in some ways I love that, but in other ways I hate it. Sometimes I'm like, especially these days in life where I have a lot of other things threatening to get in the way of me training all the time. Yeah. It would be nice to not suck so bad.
Yeah, like you
at climbing in those moments.
It'd be great to go to Disney World and not have to like climb Epcot Center to stay in shape.
Yeah, totally. So now when I travel around to cities, I look for climbing gyms. I go to climbing gyms every day and I have to stay on it. Or I just let it go for like 6 months or a year at a time and I'm just like, screw it, I'm not going to be good at climbing right now. And then I'll have to take another 4 months to build back up.
Jeez. Yeah. When you walk into gyms now, people must be like, whoa, aren't you that guy from that thing that I saw that one time?
Yeah, it is somewhat hard to go to climbing gyms in that way. I make sure I go like midday between like 11 and 3 p.m. because there's not many people in the gym then.
Yeah. So if you want to catch Tommy at the climbing gym between 11 and 3, wherever he's got an event. Here's the story you're probably sick of telling, but I'm going to go for it anyway because it's super interesting. The Kyrgyzstan thing. This incident is a topic that's really familiar to me, unfortunately. Getting abducted, not by Islamic militants, but, you know, getting kidnapped in general really sucks. I'm with you on that.
Yeah.
You're 21 years old. Why are you in Kyrgyzstan? Most people are like, well, that's your problem. Idiot went to Kyrgyzstan. Anytime you go to a place that ends in Stan, you're asking for trouble.
Yeah, I guess that is part of the problem.
Maybe, yeah.
I mean, I was into climbing in Yosemite, and I wanted to get a little more exotic and remote. I mean, like going on expeditions to exotic places it's the fantasy, right? Mm-hmm. So Kyrgyzstan seemed like the perfect fit. It was in a place that was remote. The weather was good. There was big unclimbed walls there and we wanted to explore. And then the North Face approached my girlfriend with this opportunity to go and they would pay for the trip. So, and climbers hadn't been abducted really ever that I know of in these like Himalayan or sub-Himalayan regions back then. So it wasn't like we went there even considering this as a possibility.
Right. Yeah. You're thinking food poisoning or maybe like you get injured and you have to go home, not like...
Yeah. We were certain that the dangers that we would encounter on the mountains were going to be the only dangers.
Yeah. Not the Taliban cloned IMU, right?
Yeah. It's the Islamic movement of Uzbekistan.
So were you on the border of Uzbekistan and Kyrgyzstan then?
The borders are all really close together there. We're in Kyrgyzstan, close to Uzbekistan, also close to Tajikistan.
Did you have any idea of this? I mean, you must have looked on the internet and people are like, oh, don't go there. And you're like, it says the same thing about every country now.
Yeah, there was an element of that. So I think the year previous, some Japanese tourists had gotten involved in a little bit of civil unrest. And so there was a slightly elevated warning on the U.S. State Department website. It was actually just classified as a counselor information sheet.
Mm-hmm.
And so we saw that and we're like, what does this mean? Like, how do you read this? And so we started to look around, like, what other countries in the world have this level of warning? And we came across Australia at the time had the same level of warning because of the Olympics. And so we're young, a little bit naive. We probably should have looked into it more. But we're like, well, people are still going to the Olympics.
Yeah. Well, Mexico has like a super high warning half the time. And people are like, $97 flight.
Yeah.
See you there.
Yeah. And to be fair, what happened to us was very unique. Like,
yeah.
It was super unlucky. Like, people still go climbing there all the time, even though the dangers are much higher in a lot of ways than they were the year that we went.
So what happened? You're hanging out, sleeping in a cocoon on the side of the mountain. What are those things called?
Portal ledges.
The portal ledge. Yeah. So is it literally exactly like it sounds, like you have a ledge that's portable and you add it to the side of the mountain?
Yeah, it's like a lawn chair or hanging cot that can hang from the side of the mountain, essentially. It's a platform that you erect and you clip in and then... Yeah.
So you're strapped into that thing. You're not going to like be dreaming and roll off the side of the mountain.
Right. Yeah. You're tied in generally. Yeah.
That saves me from a lot of future nightmares of being on a portal edge and rolling off the side.
Everybody finds that so terrifying, but it actually, compared to like clinging onto the side of the cliff,
yeah,
it feels real nice to be in a portal edge. It feels super comfortable.
I would say so, right? Like you're either splayed out like Spider-Man and you're like, finally, I can sit down.
Totally.
I mean, it must be awesome at the end of the day to do that.
Yeah.
Yeah. So, okay. So you're on the portal edge. Do you think you're dreaming when you, in the beginning of this? Like, how does this even begin?
Yeah. So we were 1,000 feet up this wall called the Yellow Wall, camped in these portal edges. And at twilight, so like 6 a.m., we heard gunfire, which seemed odd, being as how we're in the middle of this very peaceful-seeming valley. At first, we didn't know that we're being shot at, but pretty soon, they kept shooting, and bullets actually started to ricochet off this like ceiling of rock above us. And so that's how we were captured. They came to the base of the wall, they shot up at us, and we knew that we had to go down. We had a long telephoto camera lens that we could look down and see these guys with big guns clad in army fatigues.
I mean, I can't even believe they were able to... accurately, or maybe they were aiming at you and they missed. I don't know.
No, they had like sniper style rifles. They knew exactly what they were doing. They were able to be very accurate.
Dang. Well, good thing, I suppose, that they were able to do that, because they could have missed and hit one of you.
Yep.
Jeez. Okay, so then what? I mean, you can't run away. You're on a mountain. You're moving at like, I don't know, how many feet per hour or something. If you try to climb up, you have to go down.
Right. We have to go down. We sent the oldest member of our expedition down first. We hoped that they were just going to rob us or something. But when he got down, they just said that we had to all come down. So, yeah, we all went down, and they took us back to our base camp that was like a mile away, where they'd slashed open our tents. And
did they not know tents have zippers on them?
Yeah, they just hadn't bothered. They took knives. Yeah, they had raided all of our food, and we're like, okay, things are pretty serious. Mm-hmm. But then as we're kind of surveying the scene, a helicopter flew up valley, and the Kyrgyz military was basically coming into the valley at that time to combat the rebels of the Islamic movement of Uzbekistan, and we were right there in the mix of it. And
jeez.
So, yeah, we essentially a small war broke out.
You're in like a battle scene right now, but you want to get captured, or you'd love to have the Kyrgyz military run in on you, because then you're free, right?
Yeah, I mean, that was our hopes, but the Islamic movement of Uzbekistan had gotten to us first and taken us hostage.
Mm-hmm.
And so we were human shields on some level. They had also taken a Kyrgyz soldier hostage. He was the military outpost in that valley. He actually mm-hmm. lived in that valley. They had killed some of his friends.
Oh, man.
And so he had blood on his pants. We didn't know that they had killed his friends at that moment, though. He started looking at us, and he's like, we need to find ways to like attack these guys. Mm-hmm. He grabbed a tent pole, and he's like, we need to stab them. You know, make all these like motions, like we need to overcome these guys with big guns by attacking them with tent poles.
And you probably thought that was a bad idea, and he's like, you don't understand. They're going to kill all of us.
Yeah.
But he couldn't really communicate that to you at that time.
Yeah, I mean, he couldn't communicate it so articulately, but he got the message across.
Oh, so you knew that he, because you could see how scared he was, I guess,
yeah.
Right? Yeah. Oh,
yeah,
man.
I mean, he was making motions like putting his hand across his neck, which, you know, obviously means death, like somebody's going to die, but we didn't know if he meant us or what.
Yeah. Oh, man. So then they're taking you around somewhere, right? Like, what was their plan?
We don't know really what our plan was. We think that they were going to try and take us into Uzbekistan. We probably would have ended up in some camp and held for ransom.
Mm-hmm.
But what ended up happening is when the Kyrgyz invaded, we had to abandon everything, all of our food, warm clothing, and just basically run for it.
Oh,
so
man.
I had one small bag, which I had 6 power bars in. The rebels brought their guns, and that's all we had. Pretty soon when that battle broke out, we were on like one hillside behind this boulder, and the Kyrgyz military was on the other side, and we're with that soldier. His name was Turat, and they shot him point blank in the head. For about 4 hours, we had to kind of lay on his body behind this boulder as this battle raged until it got dark and we were able to escape over this hillside.
At the point at which they killed him, you must have been, what's going through your mind at that time? Because I guess they got rid of him because he was a soldier and knew the area and was maybe not as valuable as Americans? I mean, what was it?
Well, I think once the battle broke out, they had to turn their guns towards the other Kyrgyz soldiers.
Gotcha.
And if he was right next to you, he was going to attack them.
Sure.
So
they just knew that he was too much of a liability.
Oh, geez. Laying on a dead body that was just murdered by the people that now have you. What are you thinking at that point?
I mean, it's just surreally intense. Like, yeah. Even today, I look back on it and it seems like I watched it through a mirror or something. It doesn't feel quite real. But there was this sort of like intense, really quick bonding of the four of us. Like, mm-hmm. we were all intensely aware of each other and trying to make sure that we were gonna do everything we could to live through it. You know, nobody was like freaking out or breaking down. We were just all very on point, trying to do whatever we could.
You must have been cold if you don't have your clothes. I mean, freezing, hungry.
Yeah, I mean, at first during that battle, you don't notice the coldness right. because it's very intense. But over the next 6-day period, because we were hostages for 6 days, we were in and out of various stages of hypothermia a lot of that time because we were at 11,000 feet in elevation. We were often wet. It was like there was an amount of suffering involved, both physical and mental, that was unlike anything I had experienced before.
Yeah, that makes sense. I would imagine if you weren't a climber used to being already, you know, tossed into the snow by your dad, you know, in the middle of winter and whatever, the park to camp alone, you would have been even worse off.
Yeah,
right?
Yeah, no, that was a huge part of it. I think ultimately we survived because we were climbers and yeah. we were used to that environment to a degree that even our captors were not. Like, we were used to being on steep terrain.
Yeah, it seems like after a while, I know a couple of the guys left you after a while to go, what, look for food or something like
yeah,
that?
Yeah, we don't know. Yeah, two of our four captors just disappeared.
Wow.
Night one. We don't know what happened to them.
Jeez. And then how did you end up getting out of that situation? I mean, I know you're at this point starving. You'd been going through rivers and stuff like that. And what was your strategy, actually, to get away?
So on our first night, Jason Singer, the guy who put the expedition together, who's actually an employee of the North Face, we were running from that battle scene and we got to this raging river and we didn't know if the Kyrgyz military was pursuing us at this time. And we couldn't figure out how to get across this river. And the rebels were trying to push this big log across the river and they kind of couldn't do it. And he like grabbed this log and jumped into the river and was like kind of getting swept away. And I was like, what is he doing? He's going to get swept away. And he managed to pull this log across the river. And so then we could all climb across. And once we got to the other side, the soldiers looked at him and they're like, soldat!
Oh, you know, yeah.
They were like, or the rebels looked at him and they were like, you're a soldier. And he had done this very strategically. He's like, I wanted them to feel like we were helping them, like we were on their side. And mm-hmm. then we were really tough. And that set up a huge amount of trust that probably ultimately helped us escape.
So how did you escape? How did you finally get away from these guys?
So we spent 6 days all getting very skinny and yeah. suffering a lot. And the two members, Jason and John, were thinking that we needed to find a way to overcome our captors, like mm-hmm. steal their guns, shoot them, bash them over the head with rocks, throw them off a cliff, something like this. Beth and I, my girlfriend and I, we were the other two climbers. We didn't think that. We thought we should just try and outlast them. But on this sixth night, the head captor, Abdul, went back to our base camp to try and get some food. And the plan was for us to kind of beeline it straight up this really steep mountainside. And he was going to circle around with some food and meet us on top. And so we started climbing up this mountainside in the middle of the night under moonlight that ended up being real steep. And so our captor, our one remaining captor, who is like this 18-year-old hired mercenary who was super scared, was the only one looking after us. And it became really obvious that this was our chance to escape. So, you know, the plan, like I said, was for Jason and John, the two other male members of our expedition, to kind of guide him from below. And then Beth and I would be sort of pioneering the route above. And then they were going to look for a chance to push him off the cliff. But they could never quite do it. It's just like a hard thing to do, I guess.
Yeah.
And so when we got right near the top of the cliff, our one remaining captor kind of got excited about the prospect of being away from the exposure. And so he started to scramble ahead. And there was rain in the air, and we were already on the verge of hypothermia. And I was like, if we get wet, we're probably done for at this point. So I was like, I think our only chance to escape this. All I did is I turned to my girlfriend and I said, I don't think they're going to be able to do this. Do you think I should do it? And she just like didn't say anything. So that signified to me that she had come around and mm-hmm. she agreed with me. So I ran up behind them and kind of at the last possible moment grabbed him and pulled him off the cliff and watched him fall about 20 feet, hit this ledge, and then bounce off into blackness.
At that moment, were you relieved? I feel like I'd have some mixture of relief and then also just like you said, it was surreal. I'm just wondering if it even sunk in right away, I guess.
Yeah, no, there's no relief. It was like my immediate reaction was like the loudest noise you'd ever. It was like intense,
just like, what have I just done? I like ran up to the top of the mountain where I was no longer in the exposure, and I just like curled up in a ball, just like grabbed myself, and I was like, what did I just do? And then the other members caught up with me and, you know, tried to comfort me as best they could. But it was very urgent because we thought that Abdul was just around the corner.
Oh, the possibly. Guy who left to get food.
Right.
Oh, so you're thinking, what if he just saw that whole thing go down? We better get out of here.
Yeah. So we didn't linger, you know, maybe 30 seconds or something. And then we were off down the valley.
Oh, my God.
And so it was very intense. So.
Did you know where to go after that? I mean, did you just backtrack?
Yeah. So on a few days into our expedition, Jason and John had gone on this long hike to try and get to a phone, essentially, which, you know, they were going to get to this road that we knew was like 30 miles from our camp. And they had never made it to the phone. But what they did do is they came across a small military outpost that was down the valley that was just like a single or like one or two guys. And so they knew that that existed. And so our plan was to get to that.
Imagine being stationed out there. That's like, you just know nobody likes you back in your home base if you're the two guys that have to sleep in that shack in the middle of nowhere.
Yeah, I mean, there's a lot of that in those mountains. Like, you just have a military presence.
Yeah, just looking for, drug smugglers and Taliban-like guys?
Yeah, I mean, ultimately, the IMU's mission was to pave an opium trade trail through those mountains. Politically, it was a little bit more complicated than that, but there's a little bit of that going on.
Yeah, they wanted to fund their uprising. But hey, if they get a bunch of money in the meantime selling drugs, no big deal, right?
Right. Yeah, they got to fund their revolution.
Exactly. Yeah. You're religious now, right? You're Christian?
Yeah, I would say loosely,
Yeah. There's no really tactful way to say that, I guess. Like, you're a man of faith. Sounds so ridiculous.
Right, yeah. I aspire to believe more than I probably do in reality.
I think that's literally every person of faith ever, right?
Right.
Like, the Pope probably says the same thing when he goes to bed at night.
Right, yeah.
Does having faith ever give you pause, given that you were, like, kidnapped in Kyrgyzstan by people who had blind levels of faith? Do you ever go, like, oh, I better check myself on what I'm thinking?
Yeah, I think faith is a very complicated thing, and it's the reasoning behind so many terrible things in this world, that there's also a lot of great that can come out of it. So I don't know, it's super complicated.
It is
topic.
Complicated.
And I do know that in Kyrgyzstan, when life seemed in peril and you start to think these deeper thoughts, faith is where you turn because you need comfort. I mean, I think almost everybody, even if you're not religious, you start to wonder if you should be religious.
Yeah, I think if I was on a mountain with a bunch of my friends and a couple of psychos with guns, I'd be like, okay, Jesus, I've been kind of a dick.
Yeah.
Haven't paid much of attention to you, but if you're real, show up now. This is a good time.
Yeah, and those thoughts can be helpful.
Yeah, I would imagine you're sitting there freezing and hungry.
Yeah.
You know, and there's not, are these mountains, are they like grassy or is it just, you're just on rocks?
They're like desert mountains. There's grass, there's small shrubs, there's like juniper bushes, but really steep. Like, it's all these steep, like V-shaped valleys with these raging rivers down, running down them.
Yeah, so there's no place, you can't like go pick a bunch of berries. Like, there's nothing like that.
Yeah, no, there's not. We didn't. Down valley, there was an apricot grove that we passed through very quickly after I had pushed Sharapov off the cliff, but we didn't leave.
Yeah, you're like, I don't really have time for this right now.
Right.
Yeah. We'll hit McDonald's on the way out of this hellhole.
Yeah.
Do you think what happened in Kyrgyzstan gave you an idea of what you're really made of in a way that maybe made you a better climber?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, definitely. Yeah. Like, I was kind of a mildly motivated, sort of mediocre climber. On that trip to Kyrgyzstan, I was actually just like the hired rigger. I wasn't a professional climber at that point. I was just sort of like the tag along boyfriend. But that experience like reset my bar for things like pain and suffering in a way that's very useful in climbing. Like, when I'd go up into the mountains after that trip and things would get scary or painful, I'd always be able to think back to Kyrgyzstan and it'd be like, this is nothing compared to what I experienced in Kyrgyzstan. And so that gave me this curiosity behind like what we can endure as humans. And so my curiosity to explore that has fueled so much of what I've done since.
Yeah, I can imagine like you're stuck on something and you've tried it 40 times and you're like, well, at least I'm not getting abducted and sold into slavery.
Yeah.
When you starve to death.
Yeah, when you see something that dark, the rest of life looks real sunny afterwards.
Yeah,
and
sure.
So I feel like I'm like a really optimistic, like mostly very happy person after Kyrgyzstan in a way that maybe I wasn't. But it's interesting, not everybody has that kind of effect. Like, some people go the other way. They have like serious PTSD problems and they spend their lives in fear after something like that. For some reason, I went the other way. Part of that is my nature, but probably part of that is like the way I was raised.
Definitely, I think part of it is the way you're raised. There's new science now that shows, hey, resilience if you have PTSD, it's not that you're not resilient, but people who are very resilient do have, I guess, lower instances. I'd have to recheck this, but lower instances of the way that they think about traumatic experiences or the way that they process them. It's not like a matter of toughness. It's just a matter of how you frame the experience. Like, you're used to going, wow, that was cold, I'm hurting, I'm sore. That was a growth experience. Yeah. And a lot of people go, wow, I'm cold, I'm hurting, I'm sore, and this bad thing happened to me. And they don't have like the language and they don't have like the circuitry to process it in the way that reframes it as something positive.
Right. Yeah, yeah. Exactly. The confusing part is, I think a lot of people say, if I want my kids to be resilient, I need to really protect them from trauma as a child. Mm. Whereas my dad had the opposite approach. He actually exposed me to trauma, but just like the right dose.
Right.
I think that's key. It's got to be the right dose.
Yeah. Not like wake up at night with nightmares, go to the psychologist trauma, but just like, yeah, he was cold for a night. He'll be fine.
Right. Yeah. Yeah. He didn't like beat me with a stick every night. Yeah. To make me tougher.
You're listening to The Jordan Harbinger Show with our guest, Tommy Caldwell. We'll be right back after this.
This episode is sponsored in part by BizCounsel. So this is an awesome idea. I love this company. In the beginning of your business, if you're anything like me, you didn't hire a lawyer. Of course, my new business, the first thing I did was hire a lawyer. And I am a lawyer. So you have to be kind of careful because sometimes you can screw something up even if you do supposedly know what you're doing. Google is good for a lot of things, research, finding business connections, not for legal advice. It's state to state. A couple of sentences written differently can be, all, unfortunately, can be a huge difference if you ever run into trouble. And businesses, when they finally do get money and make it decently sized, they hire a lawyer on retainer because, man, I can tell you, when you need a lawyer, you want to be able to call one that you already know, not be freaking Googling. So it's not a matter of if, it's a matter of when. And what BizCounsel does is it's essentially, well, it was started by the people who founded LegalZoom. So they've come up with a new way to get businesses get real legal work done without breaking the bank. So for $89 a month, you get unlimited consultations with an attorney who's dedicated to you. And I know what you're thinking, like, what? Well, if it's $89 and it's unlimited, they're probably a huge pain to schedule and all this other stuff. It's going to be tricky. No, I'm telling you, you will get a call within 24 hours. Even a lawyer that you have on retainer often won't be able to call you within 24 hours. And they have a dedicated attorney for you. So it's someone in your state. They're going to get to know your business over time. You can pick up the phone. You can shoot them an email. And you get two free contract reviews every single month. So if you get somebody sending you an agreement and you're not sure if you should sign it, you send it to BizCounsel. They'll check it out, be back to you the next day. Or if you're writing a document, they can review what you've got and make suggestions that you can make changes in. And if you need something complex, they've got flat fee prices. So, oh, I need an operating agreement. Cool. It's going to cost this much. Not, well, I'm $400 an hour and it might be 10 hours and it might be 30. Depends on all these things. No, here's the price. This is what you pay. Done. This is why I love this business. I wish this existed when I started, and I recommend this for sure. Jason?
Get your dedicated business attorney at bizcounsel.com/Jordan. bizcounsel.com/Jordan.
I'll tell you, I'm using this, and we have a regular business attorney. It's just that this BizCounsel can do a lot of the light to medium lifting, and it's a great value. You just can't beat the price, and you can't beat the results. This episode is also sponsored by Shipp. So Jen and I have been together for 7 years. We just had a baby. I never thought I'd be able to credibly advertise a dating app, but Shipp lets you swipe for your friend. So we've been using it to help set up her brother, who's an awesome guy, and he's very picky, and it's really funny. So I can swipe right for him, essentially, and so can Jen. And then it shows who I picked, it shows who she picked, and it shows who he picked. And then there's a little chat room where all of our picks go in there with the photos and the profiles, and you can discuss them. So we're basically all up in his business. And you can have different teams. So it's like me and Jen can pick, but also some of his other friends can pick, and they're in a separate channel, or they can join our channel. So it's really, really funny. You have these multiple crews, and you have multiple groups of people that can swipe for you and discuss each one. Talk about living vicariously. There's an app for that now. Jason, tell them how they can find Shipp.
Finding a date is more fun if you do it with friends. Download Shipp. Try the dating app that lets you swipe with friends. That's S-H-I-P. Search for Shipp Dating in the App Store and start swiping today.
This episode is also sponsored in part by Borderlands.
Let's make some mayhem. Shoot and loot your way through a mayhem-fueled adventure in Borderlands 3. Blast through new worlds and enemies as one of four new playable Vault Hunters, each with deep skill trees, abilities, and customization. Play solo or with your friends to take on insane enemies, score loads of loot, and save the galaxy from a fanatical threat. Mayhem is available now on PC, Xbox One, and PS4. Order now at Borderlands.com. Rated M for mature. Thank you for listening and supporting the show. Your support of our advertisers keeps us on the air. To learn more and get links to all the great discounts you just heard so you can check out those amazing sponsors, visit jordanharbinger.com/deals. And don't forget the worksheet for today's episode. That link is in the show notes at jordanharbinger.com/podcast. If you're listening to us in the Overcast player, please click that little star next to the episode. We really appreciate it. And now for the conclusion of our episode with Tommy Caldwell.
You do have either really bad luck or you're subconsciously seeking out experiences that'll make you tougher, because you end up having one of the accidents that, as a climber, you just kind of can't have and continue. For some reason, you decide to do a remodel yourself and you freaking cut your finger off, man.
Yeah, I mean, I think that's probably a big flaw within me, is that I expose myself to more risk than I probably should. So I was more careless than I probably should have been without knowing enough about power tools and chopped off my finger.
Yeah, and not just any finger, like one of the most important fingers that you use in climbing.
Yeah, I would say they're all pretty important.
Oh, okay, well, I'm a novice.
Yeah, but the index finger isn't a good one to lose.
Yeah, so what happens then? What, you cut this thing off, they can't just sew it back on? I mean, I feel
they
like
tried. Yeah, they all tried. Right. My dad showed up at the hospital with like a magazine cover and was like, look, he's good climber, you have to do everything you can.
Oh, wow.
And so they did. I went through, I think usually in my circumstance, they would have just been like, well, you're going to be fine without a finger. And they just would have sewed up the stump and, you know, sent you home like a few hours later. For me, they tried to reattach it. I spent 2 weeks in the hospital, but it didn't work.
Jeez.
So yeah, they kind of did everything they can. And I think I had this hope that they were going to be able to reattach it. But then at the end of the 2 weeks, they came in and they're like, we've done everything we can. Your finger's dead. We're going to have to remove it for good. And then the doctor told me that he thought I should start thinking about what else I want to do in life.
Ugh, that's not a comfortable conversation at all.
I sometimes wonder if he strategically did that, because that fueled me.
Yeah? Did he know
you? Honestly. I mean, he was a climber. The doctor who did the surgeries, I had two doctors. I had one that did the surgeries, and I had one that was kind of like there for emotional support, who kind of took me under his wing because he was a climber as well. And that was the doctor that told me that I should think about what else I want to do. And I mean, at first when he said that, I was like, oh, you know, like bummer.
Yeah.
But then he left the room, and Beth, my girlfriend, she turned to me and she's like, fuck that guy. No idea. And so I went after climbing with this sort of passion that I didn't have before.
That and makes sense.
It was really liberating, actually, because everybody thought that I would fail. Nobody thought I'd be a good climber anymore, and I didn't really think I'd be a good climber anymore. So when I started climbing in it and I realized that I actually still could climb pretty well, I exceeded my own expectations and others. So each time I would get better, it was like, it was very liberating, and I could always do more and better than I thought, and it just started this flywheel turning that went...
Got you some new momentum.
Yeah. It created this incredible momentum. Within a year, I was doing climbs that I hadn't been able to do without my finger.
Really?
My finger.
With your finger, yeah. That's amazing. So what do you do? Like, cutting off the tip, I would imagine the tip is full of, like, little... It's calloused all up and stuff. Like, did you kind of have to rebuild your... nub, for lack of a better word? Sorry.
Well, I don't use that finger for climbing, really. It's like too short.
Oh, okay.
But I did have to use other fingers. And there was like some small injury type stuff that happened because my hand had to just readjust to the imbalances that are created by not having that finger. But mostly I just trained the same way I always did, but with just a little bit more fire and a little bit more strategy too. Like I worked harder on specific finger strength building techniques. Like I did a lot of more like indoor hanging from a hang board, doing this thing called a campus board, doing like weightlifting with my fingers and stuff to try and make my fingers strong. And it turns out specific finger strength scientifically is the best metric between like really good climbers and only mediocre climbers. Like the ones that are really, really good, it's all about the fingers.
Did you try that grip strength thing that the Mind Pump guys, we're using the Mind Pump studio. It's one of my favorite shows. I love these guys. But is that why that thing's hanging out? Because they got that for you?
I showed up and they like put that thing in my hand and they're all squeezing it. And they had me squeeze. They're like, oh, that's pretty good.
All you got? You probably crushed them and they're like, we don't want to admit it.
Yeah, I don't think. I mean, the funny thing about climbing is it's all strength to weight ratio.
Sure.
It's actually more effective to be
light than it is to just be real strong.
Yeah, that makes sense. Because you can be pretty strong, but if you're 250 pounds, like, unless you're really built in an inhuman Hulk way, you're not going to be able to do like 100 pull-ups or whatever the equivalent is that you're doing on that mountain.
Right.
Do you ever go to like the airport and you're pushing the elevator button and you're like, dang, that finger's gone. Let me switch. I mean, you're used to it now, right? But in the beginning, it must have been like, you hear about people who try to scratch an itch or the part of their body that's missing itches and you can't scratch it.
Yeah. So the weird thing for me is I think early on after I lost my finger, I think when I was shaving like the right side of my face, I would feel like there was dirt underneath that fingernail that was no longer there.
Oh,
it was like
weird.
This annoying sensation. So yeah. The body had to rewire the nerves a little bit. And so I had phantom sensation. I never had a lot of phantom pain. Like for some people, it can be real painful. Mm-hmm. I never had that though.
So does it just go away? Because you can't scratch an itch that isn't there. Right, so...
Yeah, I think your brain kind of figures it out in the end. It kind of rewires itself. I think I still do have those sensations at times, but now I associate them with being at the end of the nub instead of the end of the finger that's no longer there.
Or you just have to, like, remap it in your brain.
Yeah, but sometimes if I'm really stressed about something, I'll try and press an elevator button or something with that finger that's no longer there.
Autopilot?
Yeah.
Yeah? Like, dang it, I'm late for my... Oh, what's the problem here? Oh, right. Yep. Yeah, sure. No finger.
Yep.
When did you start getting obsessed with The Dawn Wall, the subject of the movie? And we'll link to it in the show notes. Really excellent flick. It's on Netflix. When did you start going, I'm going to do this actually previously impossible thing?
So I got really excited about El Capitan specifically shortly after Kyrgyzstan and cutting off my finger, actually a little bit before then, but I really got into it after those. And I wanted to find that limit of what I was capable of. It was it was an exploration of that. And so I went and I climbed all the existing routes on that wall. And then I started putting up new ones. And I spent basically 12 or 14 years of my life just like becoming the expert of that wall. Mm-hmm. Essentially, I got totally obsessed by it. But none of the climbs ever took me like more than a month. They all went down pretty easy. And so I had this like burning desire to see how far I could actually take it. And so since I was so experienced on that wall, I knew that the faces that from afar look completely absurdly blank might actually be possible if you train for them enough. So I sort of identified this route, which ultimately became the Dawn Wall, to take on as a project. Like all the other routes followed these crack systems, and this wall didn't have any crack systems. So to me, I was like, maybe this is possible. Everybody else was like, that's stupid. Why would you even think about that? Like, there's no way that can be climbed.
Mm-hmm.
But since I had spent so much time on there, I was like, man, I can do something. I think that's what appealed to other climbers is once I started to kind of piece it together, I was like, I think this route actually might exist. It really started to spark the interest of other climbers because sort of blew their expectations out of the water. It's the most famous big wall in the world, this thing that everybody knew would never be free climbed. There's a guy who says it might be possible.
Yeah. It looks easier to climb a frickin' skyscraper or a building or a brick wall that looks, to someone like me, flat than it does this section of rock. The section of rock, when I'm looking at Netflix and I'm looking close up, there's a little crack in there where I'm thinking, yeah, if I had a business card, maybe I could slide it in there and it would be... But you're grabbing onto things like that are credit card edge thick and you're holding yourself up on there somehow.
Yeah, I mean, that's the appeal. Like, you have this 3,000-foot tall face, and the holds are barely there. You wonder if there's enough there. Mm-hmm. So you spend all this time trying to figure out the path, and, you know, the difference between what's climbable and what's not climbable is maybe, like, a piece of rock the size of a pinhead or something like that. And so it's just this incredible puzzle. And so you spend all this time trying to piece together that puzzle and train yourself to be able to grab onto those small holds and then figure out all the logistics behind enduring the amount of time that it will take to live up there for, you know, 19 days, which it ultimately took to climb the route. And so, yeah, there's just so many things to get fascinated by. There's a huge element of memory, and then there's the whole partnership side of it. I mean, I don't know. It's just a really cool, fascinating pursuit.
So you're up there for weeks at a time. Are people sending things down, or did you have to carry all the water you were going to need the whole way up?
We worked on the climb for 7 years. And usually what we would do is we would go there at the beginning of the season and we would fix a bunch of ropes to the wall. We'd walk to the top, actually, and then rappel down and attach these ropes to the wall, which is kind of like an elevator that allowed us to attach these ascenders to the rope and kind of commute around and work on the hardest sections of the climb. And so we were going up and down pretty constantly for like a month. And each time we'd go up, we'd bring more supplies and we we established a camp, basically, a third of the way up the wall, which became our base camp for the whole siege. And we had pre-stashed it with a lot of equipment. And we would have actually had enough for our whole 19-day ascent. But since it became a documentary film project, mm-hmm. we had to sort of like share those supplies with the film team because they have to live up there with you.
Oh, yeah.
So we had to sort of like, it was actually an advantage in the end. Like they had to hire essentially a porter to recharge their camera batteries and kind of commute up and down these ropes. And we could use that porter and be like, can you bring some extra, you know, green M&Ms for us?
Yeah, yeah. No brown M&Ms. That must have been, imagine who gets that job. They're like, so what we need is for you to go up and down this insanely difficult mountain, but you have to carry a bunch of our stuff, including bags full of poop.
Yeah, totally. No, there's actually plenty of takers. There's a lot of people who want the chance to live in Yosemite and make a little money. And once the ropes are there, it doesn't take a whole lot of skill to go up and down.
Sure.
Like the difficulty lies within trying to free climb. You know, if you're just descending fixed ropes, any relatively experienced climber can figure out how to do that.
So you're spending years finding the way to go up this initially. How do you remember how to get up later on? That to you looks like a walk through my neighborhood does to me, right? Being on that wall. Because to me, it looks like a flat rock. To you, it looks like it's a very clear map.
Yeah, I mean, we spend an insane amount of time memorizing. And my partner, Kevin Jorgensen, had an almost photographic memory for climbing movement from year to year. Like, we spent our nights talking about the specifics of the moves in a way that would have made anybody who wasn't trying to climb the route with us totally batty. I mean, we would spend hours and hours discussing the nuances of body position, and we had to memorize literally tens of thousands of, maybe hundreds of thousands of small details and then try and execute them perfectly. So that's one of the reasons it took so long.
I can imagine. I'm surprised it didn't even take longer than that to go through and memorize and then do the whole thing. And in some places, you guys were stuck for like days on the same pitch, the same stretch of rock. Is that basically what a pitch is? Like the same section of rock?
Yeah, so ropes, you can really climb with a 3,000-foot rope. So what you have to do is break the big wall into pitches, which are rope lengths. And, you know, usually the ropes are 200 feet long. So you try and find stances or small ledges, but on that wall, there's not really ledges. So what we try and find is places where there's a big enough hold that we can let go with our hands, and we call that a no-hand stance. Mm-hmm. And so you map it out, and you break it from one no-hand stance to the next into pitches. There's 32 pitches, and the goal is to climb each one of those 32 pitches in order from bottom to top without returning to the ground. But if you fall on one of those pitches, you can return back to the beginning of the pitch. That's kind of like a brief overview of the rules of the game.
Yeah, that makes sense. You're right. It's not like you don't have to do the whole thing in one stretch. You don't have to do all like... You are able to reset. You just can't use the rope to pull yourself up. That's basically the main rule. I guess the main rules of this. Most people that I know who are obsessed singularly with things like this are often running from something in their life. Like, were you kind of like, I'm going to focus on this mountain because every stuff behind me is kind of messy.
Yeah. There was an element of that for sure. Like the girl that I mentioned in Kyrgyzstan, Beth, who I later married, my relationship with her broke up around the time or at the time that I decided to really take on the Dawn Wall as a project.
Mm-hmm.
And so, you know, like so many great endeavors in life, they're fueled by failed relationships.
Yeah, I feel you. I get it.
So there was definitely an element of that. So that's how it started, actually. Yeah. I needed like a distraction from the like pain of that. But after a few years, I just got so fascinated in the project. And, you know, I met my now current wife, who is just such an amazing human. And so it really turned towards the positive, towards the exploring and sort of like that incredible journey that we were on pretty quickly.
This whole thing, though, turned into like the moon landing. You know, people were watching this all over the place, but you guys were stuck on the side of the mountain. So I remember Barack Obama and like Ellen and celebrities talking about this kind of stuff on Twitter, I think, at the time.
It blew up in the media, like it went viral in the media, strangely, like in a way that we absolutely didn't plan. There's no way we could have anticipated it, but the climb just became very dramatic. Like we were using Instagram on our third year, and I was pretty against it at first. I was like, man, this needs to be about us and kind of our own journey. Mm-hmm. If we're thinking about telling this story to other people, it just like takes the soul out of it.
Mm-hmm.
But then people enjoyed it so much that a few years later, I was like, okay, I kind of feel selfish for just wanting to keep this whole experience to myself. So we kept doing that. And so there was a way for the story to get out.
Mm-hmm.
And so on that seventh year where we ultimately became successful, a reporter from the New York Times named John Branch picked up the story, pitched it to the newspaper. I think it was a super slow news cycle or something. They picked it for the cover and people were really interested. And so they just kind of gave an overview of what was going on, but then they did a profile on me another day, a profile on Kevin another day. They ran a huge photo spread another day, and then Kevin started to fail. And so then there was this whole like conversation about what's more important in climbing, like the brotherhood and the teamwork or personal success, because I had the opportunity to go to the top and like leave, or should I wait for him? And so it just became this very dramatic, long sporting event.
Yeah.
It's kind of like, I think I've realized that, you know, the Olympics is an event, right? It lasts like a couple weeks or something. And so everybody gets involved. And so that gives a lot of time for people to learn about it and more people to get interested in it.
Yeah, momentum builds up.
Yeah, the fact that the climb took us so freaking long allowed that momentum to build.
Yeah.
And so by the time we got to the top, like every news source, you know, in the world, there was, you know, worldwide news reporters in Yosemite. There was like 10 news trucks.
It's crazy.
Yeah, the president was tweeting about us.
How aware were you of this happening while you're up there? Because you're not really, I mean, you're not checking your email every day.
Well,
or are you?
You are. So, yeah, we have a solar panel with us, and you get pretty good 4G service. Ironically, the best cell service in Yosemite Valley is from the side of El Cap.
That's funny.
So we saw it blowing up in the media, and at first we were like, whoa, this is crazy. And then pretty quickly we were like, this is a bad distraction.
Yeah.
And so Kevin and I were like, okay, we will do like our normal Instagram update once a day, but we're not going to like allow, I think right at the beginning we did a interview with the New York Times and another one with NPR, and then we just cut it off. We're like, nothing else. And then I dropped my phone off the wall.
Did you drop it or did you throw it?
Yeah, I dropped it.
Okay.
Yeah.
Because I feel like I'd be like, sorry, I dropped it.
Yeah. And so I didn't really have to deal with reading any of the articles, which was super nice at that point. So we were aware, we could see it going on, but we didn't really have to deal with it per se until we got to the top.
Do you think differently now about death-defying climbs like this now that you're a father? Because I feel like I might take fewer dangerous trips now that I have my own son who's in the room with us right now being really good.
Right. So a lot of the climbing that I do is pretty dangerous, and I think very heavily about that stuff as a father. The Dawn Wall was like the perfect place for me because it actually wasn't all that dangerous. The wall is super sheer. The ropes are strong. You can fall 100 feet and you don't hit anything.
Mm-hmm.
So thankfully, it feels exciting. It feels like it should be dangerous. But if you think about it logically, it's not all that dangerous. So the effect is that that fulfills me, that fulfills that adventurous need that is very strong within me in a way that I feel like I can do as a father and be responsible. So that's why I love El Cap these days. That's why I still, you know, I'm going to go there in a few weeks again and spend another season in Yosemite, because it's the one place that is safe but really adventurous
and has great cell phone service.
Yeah, I can. And I can bring my family. They can camp and they love it there.
Yeah,
yeah.
What do you want to pass down that you learned on El Cap? What do you want to pass down to your kids aside from technical climbing skills or outdoor skills? What did you learn on that mountain that you want your kids to know?
Oh, well, first, I'm not certain I want to pass down climbing.
Oh, really?
I mean, I don't know. The risky parts of climbing are kind of addicting, and I have a lot of friends that have died, and I have some friends whose kids have died, and so I get to see that firsthand, what that's like. And so, I don't know, but there is a lot of great things about climbing that, like, this want to dream big and be part of something that feels so grand, and the ability to find grit and suffer through experiences and value growth. And, you know, there's so many things that can be really, really great for climbers that climbing does build. And if I can keep them interested in the safe disciplines of climbing, mm-hmm. like sport climbing and bouldering, that's just going to be all positive.
Yeah.
But the problem is, since I've been decent at the more dangerous disciplines of climbing, they might see that as an opportunity. And they'd have the tools to go there if they wanted.
Sure. Yeah. Like, oh, I want to make my dad proud. I'm going to do something even more ridiculous than try to climb the Dawn Wall. Right?
Yeah. And in a way, the risky elements of climbing for people who know how to assess that risk are an easy way out. Like, you can go and do something that other people think is really awesome and that gains you a lot of notoriety without having to put in that much work just because you're able to assess the risk, whereas the real physical elements of climbing, like sport climbing and bouldering, you actually have to train your ass off and get really good. And even then, you most likely will never be noticed.
That crying sound you hear means we're running out of time. So what's next for you? Are you going to, you kind of killed your white whale, right? With the Dawn Wall. Like, I don't know what you're thinking, but if I were in your shoes, I'd be like, I'm good. I'm going to take it a little bit easy now, but maybe that's not in your nature.
Yeah, I don't think taking it easy is in my nature. I mean, climbing's been great, but relatively self-serving. And I feel like I want to pursue things that have a little bit more purpose. So the last few years of my life has been trying to get comfortable with sharing my story so that people can maybe, you know, hopefully find a little bit of inspiration from it.
Yeah.
These days, I'm actually getting into activism work.
Okay.
And so who knows? Who knows where that'll take me. But, you know, trying to, and if it does, it feels more purposeful, like trying to figure out a way to make sure that humanity doesn't totally screw themselves over.
Self-annihilate.
It feels a little more valiant than, you know, climbing big rock faces.
You got to do one to get the profile to do the other one, right?
So. That's right. Yeah, I have no regrets. That's for sure.
Tommy, thank you very much, man. It's been fascinating.
Yeah, thank you.
Thank you to Tommy Caldwell. That was really interesting. Man, what a fascinating guy. The movie is called The Dawn Wall, and it's on Netflix, and the book is called The Push, available wherever fine books are sold. Links to all that will be in the show notes, and there's a video of this interview on our YouTube channel at jordanharbinger.com/YouTube. There are also worksheets for each episode, as you know, so you can review what you've learned from Tommy Caldwell. Those are at jordanharbinger.com in the show notes. And I'm teaching you how to connect with great people such as Tommy and manage relationships using systems, using tiny habits in just a few minutes a day. And I'm teaching you that for free. So go to jordanharbinger.com/course and don't do it later. Do it now because, of course, you're going to procrastinate. You'll do it later. You got to dig the well before you get thirsty. Once you need relationships, you are too late. The drills take a few minutes a day. I wish I knew this stuff 20 years ago. Ignore it at your own peril. jordanharbinger.com/course. And by the way, most of the guests on the show, they subscribe to the course and the newsletter. So come join us. You'll be in smart company. Speaking of building relationships, you can always reach out and or follow me on social. I'm at Jordan Harbinger on both Twitter and Instagram. This show is created in association with Podcast One, and this episode was produced by Jen Harbinger, Jason DeFilippo, and edited by Jace Sanderson. Show notes and worksheets by Robert Fogarty, music by Evan Viola, and I'm your host, Jordan Harbinger. Our advice and opinions and those of our guests are their own, and yes, I'm a lawyer, but I'm not your lawyer. So do your own research before implementing anything you hear on the show. And remember, we rise by lifting others. The fee for this show is that you share it with friends when you find something useful or interesting, which should be in every episode. So please share the show with those you love and even those you don't. In the meantime, do your best to apply what you hear on the show so you can live what you listen. And we'll see you next time. This episode is sponsored in part by BetterHelp. BetterHelp, this stuff, I wish this had existed years ago. They offer licensed professional counselors who are specialized in issues like depression, stress, anxiety, relationships, sleeping, trauma, anger, family stuff, grief, self-esteem. I feel like I could check off at least half of those at some point in my life. And many of you are saying, go on. So
continue,
I understand. Continue, please. So you can connect with your professional counselor in a safe and private online environment. Anything you share is obviously confidential. That makes it convenient. You can do it all on your phone. You don't have to drive across town, find parking, schedule something, and then wait in a waiting room. Get help at your own time and at your own pace and in your own place. You could do this from your lunch hour in the parking lot of your car. You can schedule secure video or phone sessions. There's chat, there's text. And of course, you can always switch therapists if you want to. I think this is a great way for people to dip their toes in the therapy water, especially if they're like, oh, I don't want to have to go through the whole rigmarole. You don't have to. There is no rigmarole. Just go to betterhelp.com/Jordan. You'll get 10% off your first month with discount code Jordan. betterhelp.com/Jordan. You fill out a little questionnaire. It's really easy. You get paired with a counselor and you start protecting your sanity. So give it a shot and let me know what you think.